Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, another shadow on British Prime Minister Tony Blair's Iraq policy. A controversial defense ministry official is believed dead.
Also, who put the uranium in the State of the Union address? One name has surfaced. Bigger names may follow.
And in Iraq, soldiering on.
I've been in Baghdad for a couple months now, and if you got the uniform on, it doesn't matter what your job is. Anybody at any time can get you. So sitting duck, I don't know if I'd use that term, but you're a target anywhere you go once you're outside of your compound.
Also, our editorial roundtable on morale back home in towns soldiers left behind.
These stories and the coolest video flicks for the long, hot summer coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A U.S. soldier was killed in Iraq today. A bomb exploded near a bridge in the Iraqi town of Fallujah as a U.S. military convoy was passing through. NPR's Eric Westervelt is in Fallujah with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. He says the driver of a Humvee was killed in the blast, which he says was triggered by remote control.
Fallujah's been something of a hotbed for Sunni Muslim resistance to the American forces, but this was the first daylight attack in several days, and it was the first casualty for this brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division since the main combat of the war in March and April.
NPR's Eric Westervelt in Fallujah, west of Baghdad. Several other American soldiers were wounded in the blast. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz is in Iraq. As NPR's Guy Raz reports from Baghdad, Wolfowitz will be assessing the security situation for American troops.
This is the second time Paul Wolfowitz has visited Iraq since the fall of Baghdad back in April. His trip this time coincides with a growing security crisis in the country. He's basically in the country to assess the situation. He'll be here for a few days. He'll go to a few cities in the country and meet mainly with U.S. officials and military leaders to try to figure out what's going on and what might be done to restore some kind of law and order in the country.
NPR's Guy Raz in Baghdad. British police are trying to determine if a body found in central England is that of defense adviser David Kelly. Kelly had been suspected of being a source for BBC story that the government forged intelligence reports on Iraq, a claim Kelly had denied. An Oregon firefighter has been injured as crews hold the Clark fire to 1,500 acres. From Eugene, Morgan Smith has more.
The firefighter received severe cuts above and below his eye when a branch from a downed tree snapped back and hit him while he was cutting it. Officials say the man is in good condition after getting 32 stitches at a local hospital. For safety reasons, the strategy for fighting the Clark fire has switched to an indirect method, locating remote logging roads outside the fire and burning into the blaze from there.
Burned forest becomes their safety zone. Otherwise, if you're standing in unburned fuel and there's a fire coming towards you, there's nothing to slow it before it gets to you.
Frenzen says they're expecting no help from the weather, which is predicted to continue hot and dry. Officials worry predicted lightning could spark more fires across the state, stretching firefighting resources thin. For NPR News, I'm Morgan Smith in Eugene.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 38 points at 9,089 in moderate trading of 569 million shares. The Nasdaq is down a fraction of a point at 1,697. This is NPR. In this NPR business update, AOL Time Warner is expected to rake in more than $1 billion and a deal to sell the Warner Music Group DVD and CD manufacturing business to Canada's Synram International. The Toronto-based company will serve as manufacturer, printer, packager, and distributor for parent AOL CDs and DVDs in North America and Europe. In a statement, AOL Time Warner chairman and CEO Dick Parsons notes that deals totaling nearly $3.8 billion in cash this year have been earmarked for debt reduction. Microsoft and Cisco Systems are working to patch major vulnerabilities found in software used to access the Internet. NPR's Larry Abramson has more.
Cisco has discovered a flaw in the software used in many of its routers, devices used to reach the Internet. The flaw in Cisco's Internet Working Operating System, or iOS, could allow hackers to launch what are known as denial-of-service attacks, which can shut down websites by flooding them with an avalanche of traffic. The Microsoft flaw affects the core operating system in the company's NT, Windows 2000, and Windows XP software, as well as a Windows Server system. Both vulnerabilities are viewed as serious because an attacker can slip by without having to provide an identifying password, but both companies said so far no one has taken advantage of the flaws. Cisco and Microsoft have already designed patches to fix the problems. Customers are being urged to download those software programs as soon as possible. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Stocks are mixed after yesterday's technology-led selling. The pace of earnings and economic news is slowing today after a very busy week. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NTI, a charitable organization working to reduce the global threats from nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, on the web at nti.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Police in England have found a body. They think it's missing Ministry of Defense advisor David Kelly. Now, for weeks, Kelly's been the center of a whirlwind of publicity in Britain. He'd become the prime possible source for a controversial BBC report, a report that alleged Prime Minister Tony Blair's government, quote, sexed up an intelligence dossier on Iraq, in order to create a more compelling rationale to go to war. The dossier claimed, among other things, that Iraq could launch chemical or biological weapons on 45 minutes' notice. The British government says an independent judicial inquiry will investigate if the body is positively identified as Kelly's. Joining us on the line now is Glenn O'Glazer, a reporter for Britain's Sky TV. Hello, Glenn.
Hi, Bill.
Tell us about David Kelly. He certainly was a man not used to the spotlight.
No, he wasn't. He was used to pressure, but not this kind of media attention. His background is as a microbiologist, and he was head of the government's chemical weapons research establishment. And then after that, for 10 years, was one of the senior weapons inspectors in Iraq. And he had been questioned by MPs before about his role as a UN weapons inspector. The difference this time was that he was absolutely under the media spotlight. And of course, he gave evidence last Tuesday to a committee of MPs who wanted to know if he was the source of a story which was reported by the BBC over here on radio that the government had, quote, sexed up the dossier which justified going to war.
Yeah, and it gets confusing, doesn't it? Because he did say that he met with Andrew Gilligan of the BBC, but then he didn't make it clear whether he was the source of that sexed up comment.
Well, that's right. He said he wasn't, and he met with Andrew Gilligan, but didn't say the things that Andrew Gilligan reported his sources as having said. So the argument is that he was a source, but not the highly placed intelligence source.
Is there speculation that he had become particularly upset over all this?
Well, his wife is quoted as saying through a friend that he was extremely unhappy and extremely stressed by the whole experience.
Glenn, do we even know the cause of death?
It would be unfair, I think, at this stage to speculate until there's a post-mortem. That's going to be held sometime in the next few hours.
Now, for Britons who've been reading about this in their newspapers and hearing about it on television and on the radio, and what kind of a development is this?
Shock and disbelief, I think, are the two words I would use to describe everybody's reaction to this news. A very strange and very unsettling and disturbing twist. And one of the MPs said, this really puts the whole argument about dossiers and intelligence and all the rest of it into some perspective, because this is somebody's life.
Oh. Glenn, how will this affect Tony Blair, who's been under such intense fire over his Iraq policy in Britain? Does this redound at all negatively for him?
Yes, it does. I think this is a serious crisis now for the government. Tony Blair's face when he arrived in Tokyo off the plane from Washington. I mean, compared to the happy, smiling face in Washington, the Prime Minister's face in Tokyo was ashen and very grim indeed. It is a crisis for the government. I think in particular Alistair Campbell, who is Tony Blair's head of communications, who initiated and turned up the heat on this row with the BBC, and in effect smote Dr. Kelly out. So his position probably on pretty thin ice, I'd have thought.
At the very least, another shadow on the Blair government's policy in and about Iraq.
Well, the big word being used over here is trust. That trust that he's enjoyed for 5 or 6 years is being seriously eroded, and that, I think, is the most damaging thing. It's bad for the whole political system, really, that the government is not trusted in the way that it was before all this.
Yeah, yeah. Glenn O'Glaser, thanks very much for joining us on this.
You're welcome, Bill.
Glenn O'Glaser is a political reporter for Britain's Sky TV. He joined us from London. Well, back in the U.S. now, more details have emerged on how a disputed claim about Iraq's nuclear program made it into the president's State of the Union speech. According to sources present at a closed Senate hearing this week, the White House advisor who asked for the reference to be included was Robert Joseph, a top aide to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. Meanwhile, in a new dispute over intelligence, another senior administration official has delayed his plans to tell Congress that Syria's weapons of mass destruction are now a threat to stability in the Middle East. The delay comes after the CIA and other agencies said the claim was exaggerated. Both of these stories are being reported by Warren Strobel, foreign affairs correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers. He joins us from Washington. And hello, Warren.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us, Warren. First off, who's Robert Joseph and what role, so far as you know, did he play in getting those infamous 16 words about Iraq's nuclear ambitions into the State of the Union address?
Robert Joseph is a top aide to Condoleezza Rice, the president's national security advisor. He works at the White House and deals with all issues that relate to proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, some homeland defense. He's been in and out of government and Republican administrations for quite some time and is widely known as a hardliner, a conservative. His exact role, Bill, is a little bit at issue here. The Democrats are saying, according to this hearing 2 days ago, that he was insistent that the reference be included in the president's State of the Union address. People in the administration are saying that's not so. It was just a normal conversation about the evidence that was part of the preparation for the speech.
Well, what's the sense down there in Washington that he might yet end up taking the fall for this or a fall for this?
It's possible. As you know, CIA Director George Tenet at least attempted to take the fall for this last week. But there is a sense here that the whole story hasn't been told. There's a White House role that hasn't been fully uncovered. And the Democrats in Congress are trying very much to show that the White House should take the blame, not the CIA.
Now, Warren, if Robert Joseph had his fingerprints on the State of the Union address, as far as those 16 words are concerned, wouldn't his boss, Condoleezza Rice, certainly have had her fingerprints on it, too?
Absolutely. Now, I can't say for sure that she had her fingerprints on those 16 words, but one would certainly think so, and certainly no State of the Union address, especially one that focused so much on Iraq, would be delivered without complete and probably repeated reviews by the National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice.
Well, Warren, we'll keep watching this story, but let's turn now to the other intelligence dispute you're reporting. Undersecretary of State John Bolton, who's well known as a hardliner within the State Department, was apparently going to tell Congress that Syria had weapons of mass destruction programs that were a threat to the region. Well, now he's not. Tell us about that.
It's actually a very interesting story. He was going to go up on Capitol Hill on Tuesday and make some new assertions regarding Syria's weapons of mass destruction program. Anytime an official in the U.S. government goes and testifies on Capitol Hill, his testimony has to be cleared with other agencies of government. And the people in the CIA and elsewhere, places I can't name because they'd reveal sources, they they opposed what he said, and they refused to give their thumbs up, as it were. I think it's an interesting story because it shows that the intelligence professionals and analysts in the government who got beaten up so badly about Iraq are sort of pushing back and fighting back, and they may feel a little bit emboldened by this whole dispute over Iraq intelligence that we've been talking about. And it's not just an issue, sort of an arcane issue about whether Syria has chemical weapons or biological weapons. It has to do with big issues of American foreign policy about whether what our policy towards Syria is, whether we're going to invade them or pressure them militarily. So it is a very serious issue.
Warren, just to finish up, is there a deepening chasm between the CIA and the White House and State Department?
I think what's really happening here is from day one of this administration, there has been a very deep fissure between two parts of the government over virtually every issue you can name, from Iraq to North Korea to the Palestinian-Israeli peace process, on and on and on. There's been fighting behind the scenes quite bitterly for several years, and we're now seeing it come to the surface in an unusually public way.
Well, Warren Strobel, thanks so much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
Warren Strobel is the foreign affairs correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
A Pentagon fact-finding team returning from an 11-day tour of Iraq reported yesterday that there's still time to turn a faltering post-war reconstruction into a success story. But it'll take more money, more manpower, and more American troop time. Well, that last part did not sit well with many American troops who have become increasingly vocal in their complaints, so much so that the Pentagon announced it will punish soldiers who complain to the press. Well, some GIs have it better than others, and joining us are some soldiers policing the streets of Baghdad. And jump in, whoever wants to start. You asked that we use no names. Why no names?
Because they don't know that we talk to the press.
Yeah. How long have you been in Iraq?
Well, we got in country in April, right at the tail end of the actual combat operations.
Right. We've mentioned several soldiers have been very vocal in their disappointment in what's going on. I'm reading a specialist of the 3rd Infantry 2nd Brigade told ABC News, and with his name, if Donald Rumsfeld was here, I'd ask him for his resignation. How are the soldiers feeling?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I can only speak for the soldiers that I'm around. And, of course, we're tired. We're tired, and because of the long hours we pull. But, I mean, we signed up, so we got to endure. As far as Rumsfeld goes, I mean, they put him in power, so apparently he must know a little bit. I don't know. I mean, he's the head honcho, I guess.
Yeah. How are you feeling about being told you're going to stay there longer?
I'm disappointed, but, we got to do the job, I'd rather do it right the first time instead of having to come back continuously,
Soldier, can I speak to one?
Another soldier.
Yeah.
You want to talk to him?
Yeah, I would love to.
Okay, hold on.
How are you?
I'm fine. Hey, so tell me, what are you doing on a daily basis there?
Sweating.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't trying to be funny. But
no, it's really hot.
It is very hot here, especially when you got to wear all your gear and everything.
Right. Are you feeling that there is a post-war plan in place, or are you feeling, as some soldiers are, that, as Ted Kennedy said, that you're kind of set out there as sitting ducks? How are you feeling?
We just see basically what we see down the streets of Baghdad, and you see pieces of the puzzle getting put together, yes.
You do.
But it's a very slow process, yeah. Very slow.
Do you feel like sitting ducks?
Sitting duck, I don't know if I'd use that terminology. I think if you got the uniform on, it doesn't matter what your job is, anybody at any time can get you. So sitting duck, I don't know if I'd use that term, but you're a target anywhere you go once you're outside of your compound. Yeah, mm-hmm. Pretty much.
Soldier, what do you think of the soldiers who have been really complaining bitterly and vocally? One is quoted as saying to ABC News, he's a specialist with the 3rd Infantry 2nd Brigade, and he said, if Donald Rumsfeld was here, I'd ask him for his resignation. And General Abizaid has said...
Well, 3rd ID, those guys have been here a long time. Those guys, they got deployed last year sometimes. We've run into them from time to time. I mean, if anybody should go home first, it should be those guys.
Do you think it's any different this time, the complaints that we're hearing, or is this just something that happens when soldiers are in country for a long time?
That's kind of hard to answer because, you know, like I said, everybody's been here at a different length of time and everybody's doing a different job and everybody has completely different conditions. So, you know, you might even call, you know, someone's throwing a complaint and you might just call them on a bad day too, you know what I mean? I mean, most of us are police officers back home, so we're doing that job here. We get to do the stuff we love to do is help people, and, you know, and we're not out here busting heads and hurting people. We're out, you know, we've gotten a real good rapport with a lot of people and actually starting to feel safe. And someone comes and robs them or beats them up or steals their car or whatever, they're actually feeling safe to come up to the different checkpoints or where we work at out on the street. They'll pull us over and to let us know, hey, you know, can you help us? And that's slowly, that's a good part of the job, too, because people were really scared. They didn't trust the police here.
Well, Soldier, thank you very much.
Okay, no problem.
Take care and stay cool.
We'll try to. Thank you, ma'am.
Two soldiers working as police officers on the streets of Baghdad. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
According to a recent study by a British consulting firm, NGOs, or non-governmental organizations, such as Amnesty International or CARE, enjoy much greater public trust than governments or business. And with combined budgets of over $1 trillion, NGOs could become among the most influential institutions of the 21st century. Well, the American Enterprise Institute and the Federalist Society, two conservative Washington-based think tanks, agree. And they've launched a project called NGO Watch to keep an eye on the world's NGOs. Critics say with so much money being raised and spent in these tough financial times, NGOs shouldn't be allowed to hide behind the mantle of do-gooder. Well, Leonard Leo is executive director of the Federalist Society and a driving force behind NGO Watch. He joins us from San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
We're also joined by John Elkington, co-founder of Sustainability, the consulting firm that wrote that recent study on NGOs. He speaks to us from London. Hi, John.
Hi, Robin.
Well, Leonard, let's begin with you. Why did your group and the American Enterprise Institute even want something called an NGO watch?
We noticed that with increasing frequency, NGOs are playing an extremely prominent role in the development of international law and policy, and by extension, having an impact on our own domestic legal and regulatory regimes. And we felt that it was important for people to have some understanding of that trend, and also to begin to spark some debate about whether such organizations, given their impact on law and public policy, whether such organizations should have a little more transparency and accountability in the work that they're doing. And then a debate about what role NGOs should actually play.
Well, John Elkington, you're a consultant who links NGOs with businesses. What are your concerns?
Well, I think the problem sometimes is just their very sense of mission. They have this sense that they are in the world to make the world a better place, and almost anything goes in pursuit of that mission. And I think we've seen a small number of financial scandals. We've had recently the Washington Post going after the Nature Conservancy. We haven't yet had an Enron NGO, but I think part of what we're trying to do at Sustainability is to fire a shot across the NGO bows and say, look, you are going into the mainstream. You are going to have a major influence on the future. Recognize as you go into the mainstream, you'll be held to mainstream standards of accountability. Mm-hmm. The second is a financial challenge where many of the foundations that support NGOs, particularly in the United States, were heavily invested in the stock markets and have lost a huge proportion of their assets, which is going to squeeze NGOs in the coming years. The third squeeze is in the area of competition. We're finding companies and business-led networks and social entrepreneurs coming into the same space that NGOs have traditionally operated in. But instead of just simply talking about issues, they're increasingly talking about solutions. So these three challenges are all coming together.
Yeah. In fact, some critics have said that NGOs that used to attack companies from without, you know, literally maybe throwing paint at windows, are now working with businesses from within and maybe getting too cozy with big business.
I think there is a real danger of capture. I think that healthy societies, healthy economies really do depend absolutely on NGOs and their independence. And as globalization has proceeded, their role internationally has become very much more important. But it's a paradox that these groups have called for wider conditions of transparency, primarily aimed at government and at companies, and now they getting caught up in the same demands for transparency.
Well, you know, Leonard, some would say, I mean, the questions of transparency and how the NGOs are run are one thing, but some would say, gee, NGOs, they feed people, they force us to clean up the environment, our water and our air, to improve our food, they shine a light on horrendous human rights abuses, they make us think. What's the problem?
Our project is not about being against the NGO community and against the work they do, and many NGOs do supply tons of food to the world, medical supplies, educational opportunities. There's lots of good charitable work that takes place there. And I don't think any of us at the Federalist Society or AEI have a problem with organizations speaking out and providing their perspectives about what policy should look like.
Because that's exactly what your organizations do.
Well, that's precisely what we do. However, we think it's important that everybody know who that organization is, what they do, what their philosophical perspective is.
Well, given that, let's have some transparency with your own organization, or with at least American Enterprise Institute, which launched NGO Watch. 20 of AEI graduates, if you will, work in the Bush administration. They include Vice President Dick Cheney, Treasury Secretary John Snow, Richard Perle. Some would say your move is just an extension of the Bush administration, perhaps trying to put a cap on what is perceived as a liberal world, the NGO world?
Well, we decided to do this because the Federalist Society, since its founding, has believed very strongly in the idea that institutions that have a role in governance need to be accountable and transparent. There's absolutely nothing wrong with private organizations engaging in partnerships with government to develop policy as long as everybody has full information about who those groups are, what they do, what their mission is, where they get their money. I think there will be a lot of differences of opinion amongst conservatives and libertarians and free marketeers about, you know, where that line should be drawn.
Well, John, as we well know, there are many conservative NGOs.
I think the Federalist Society say that they're doing this without prejudice. That's fine. What we're doing, though, is not simply monitoring what NGOs are doing. We're very actively now getting involved in a set of processes which are intended to really provoke debate across the NGO world. So I think it's pretty much a parallel exercise to the AEI Federalist Society NGO Watch website.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Robin, very much.
Leonard Leo, Executive Director of the Federalist Society, and along with the American Enterprise Institute, a founder of NGO Watch. John Elkington, co-founder of Sustainability, a consulting firm that wrote a recent study on NGOs.
Well, next week on Here and Now, we'll speak with Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy, who's recently called U.S. troops in Iraq sitting ducks.
Also, a new documentary takes a look at a weapon that changed the world and the man who invented it, who lived in secret for 50 years. It's the Kalashnikov.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, hometown reaction to news that troops will have extended stays in Iraq.
And why not rent a little air conditioning? Videos so cool they'll lower your thermostat on steamy summer days.
Have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you were so sure was real? What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
These stories coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. A U.S. soldier was killed today when a bomb exploded under a military convoy that was crossing a bridge in the Iraqi town of Fallujah. The soldier was from the 3rd Infantry Division. His death was the 148th in combat since the war was launched nearly 4 months ago, that number surpassing the 147 killed in the 1991 Gulf War. Earlier, U.S. Army engineers defused what they described as a huge homemade bomb found on a highway near the Baghdad airport. British authorities believe a body found near London is that of an Iraqi weapons expert at the center of a controversy between the British government and the BBC. David Kelly was named as a possible source behind a BBC report that the British government had sexed up its Iraqi weapons dossier in the lead-up to the war. Detective David Purnell says Kelly's family is being kept up to date on the investigation.
The family of Dr. David Kelly have been aware of what the police have been doing in relation to the search for him. At the moment, as I say, a body has been found. We have no more further information as to the identity of that person. Those inquiries are ongoing.
Kelly denied he was the source of the story before a parliamentary committee on Tuesday. If it is confirmed that the dead man is the weapons inspector, British Prime Minister Tony Blair says there will be an independent investigation. Blair has arrived in Tokyo after his visit to the United States yesterday, where he apparently won concessions about British citizens being held as terrorist threats. A spokesman for Blair says the U.S. has agreed to suspend all legal proceedings against the 9 British prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. The head of the United Nations Nuclear Agency has strong words about North Korea today. Mohamed El-Baradei says the nation poses what he calls the most immediate and most serious threat to controlling the world's nuclear weapons. El-Baradei says he's worried about reports that North Korea is reprocessing fuel rods, which many experts believe is a step that can lead to building nuclear weapons. Tiger Woods bounced back from a rough opening round in the British Open and today closed within 3 strokes of leader Davis Love. And American Lance Armstrong is maintaining his overall lead at the Tour de France. Wall Street at midday, the Dow is up 42 points at 9093. The NASDAQ is up less than a point at 1698. The S&P 500 is up 2 points at 984. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy's responded to recent attacks on U.S. soldiers serving in Iraq by saying they've become sitting ducks. As we heard earlier in the show, life inside Iraq for the U.S. men and women serving there is no picnic.
I've been in Baghdad for a couple months now, and if you got the uniform on, it doesn't matter what your job is, anybody at any time can get you. So sitting duck, I don't know if I'd use that term, but you're a target anywhere you go once you're outside of your compound.
Back home, uncertainty too, anxiety. The 150,000 or so soldiers in Iraq all left loved ones behind and left behind communities too, hometowns. So on this week's editorial roundtable, we thought we'd check in on morale, where two of our regular contributors live. What's the sense of how the war's going? How concerned are people about those 16 controversial words about Iraq and uranium in the president's last State of the Union address? And what is being said about our troops in Iraq? Well, joining us on the line from Hyannis, Massachusetts, is Alicia Blaisdell-Bannon, managing editor of the Cape Cod Times. And welcome, Alicia.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Alicia. And from Levittown, Pennsylvania, we have Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times. Pat, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Bill.
Alicia, let's start with you. Your paper's been looking at some of your local soldiers. What's your impression of morale where you are as far as our soldiers in Iraq are concerned?
Well, we ran a story the other day about a Marine corporal who had written letters home to his little cousins talking about the war in the way that, of course, everybody wants soldiers to be talking about the war. It was going to be solved. It was about a bad little boy, was the way he phrased it for his little cousins. And then when he came back, it turned out that he had been sending letters to other people, adults, talking about the other side of it, which is how unforgiving the place is. You constantly have to watch your back. He'd seen people die. He never felt safe. There were a lot of rumors.
Oh, how interesting. So he painted for the children kind of a picture that wouldn't scare them, and to the adults he told a very different story.
That's right, and I kind of wonder if that isn't going on at higher levels, actually.
Oh, gee, yeah, that's a thought. Alicia, what did he say about how bad things are over there?
He talked about, he actually had seen soldiers die. He was a crew chief on an assault vehicle, so he is going to have to be making the decision soon, I guess, on whether he reenlists and is taking the one war may be enough position here. So I apparently it was quite bad, and he didn't feel safe. Of course, soldiers don't feel safe. That's nothing new from war to war.
Yeah, and tough for him to readjust coming back to, well, Cape Cod, such a beautiful, tranquil place.
I suppose they all are going to be having those difficulties getting back into the swing of things.
Yeah, yeah. He bought a Harley, I read.
That's one way to definitely get back in the swing.
About as American a thing as you can do. Well,
yeah.
Well, Pat Walker, what are you seeing down in Pennsylvania?
I think the spirit is supportive but cautious here. Folks are concerned about the extent of time that soldiers are spending. However, I think they're also very disturbed by the issues of not being safe, that it continues to be sort of a guerrilla-type warfare.
Yeah, Senator Ted Kennedy called it a shooting gallery. Is there a sense in Pennsylvania that our guys have been placed in a shooting gallery?
Yes, and that they're not safe, and that and that it's not an area where it is secure. So they're forced to constantly be on guard.
So does that mean that support for the war is crumbling?
I don't know that it means support for the war is crumbling. I think you'll always see a spirit of support, and we certainly do in this area, for the soldiers. But perhaps it's not crumbling, but being questioned.
Alicia, what are you finding in Cape Cod as far as how people feel about the war?
We have a pretty vigorous exchange on our letters page with people questioning the reasons for the war. I think as far as the soldiers are concerned, as far as the military, of course people are supportive. I think there is some concern that perhaps there aren't enough of them there, and that maybe we need to start saying some hard things about how long we're going to be there and what our role actually is going to be. And if we're going to be there for years instead of months, maybe we should be sending more, and where are they going to come from? I think there is a lot of debate about that.
Debate or erosion of support?
I don't think it's erosion of support for the war. I think it's just, I think there is a lack of clarity. I think people are not quite sure where this is all going.
Well, speaking of a lack of clarity, perhaps, let's turn to the issue of those 16 words of President George Bush, which have gotten so much play this week. How are people reacting to this flap in Pennsylvania, Pat Walker?
I think it's a matter of acceptance of mistakes, and they've seen it before. They're seeing it again. I think the honesty is what's the most important. If it was a mistake, if it was bad information, then say that it was. But the backpedaling is always what seems to trouble people.
So people haven't made up their minds yet where they stand on all this?
I don't see evidence that they have on our letters pages as well. Yeah. There's a questioning, but basically an appeal for the truth.
Alicia?
Yeah, I agree. I think what people want to see is they want to see it clear now. They're not so concerned about going back. I think those issues of what was said and what people actually knew and was the CIA persuaded and all that is almost more inside baseball in a way for a lot of people. I think what they'd like to see now is, okay, now what? Now what are we doing? What are our plans?
You both seem to be saying that there are a lot of unanswered questions for people out there that could cut either way eventually.
Well, I think if they start seeing large numbers of troops being harmed in, you know, attacks on vehicles where 10 or 12 soldiers are dying, yeah, and that kind of thing, it is going to change opinion pretty quickly.
I agree. Yeah. I think it's not going to be the same as 1991 where it's in, it's over, we get to leave. This is a much different situation. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again, when hundreds start dying at a time or 50 or 25, it's going to be a tougher pill to swallow. This is not the same situation.
Yeah. Well, Pat, let's shift our focus away from Iraq for a moment. What else is going on locally in Pennsylvania and thereabouts, Philadelphia?
Very hot issue in Pennsylvania are slot machines at the racetracks, and it's seen as a way to ease property taxes, and it's caught up in the state legislature right now. The Senate has approved a plan, so there's a lot of money at stake and a lot of hands in the way that it's going to be run.
So many states struggling right now.
Definitely struggling with budgets that are need to be balanced and not enough money and promises to taxpayers that they wouldn't raise taxes. And in Pennsylvania, they're looking to slot machines at racetracks as a way to ease that burden.
Well, Alicia, we're both speaking from Massachusetts, which is experiencing its own bad budget crunch.
That's right. And fees are our answer, Pat. Uh-huh. Tell them fees. They need to raise fees on everything. My favorite fee raise, though, is the hike in fees for lobbyists to register. I'm supportive of that one. That's a good one. Yeah.
That's something that maybe for once just about all voters could agree upon. Thank you both very much for joining us on this Friday.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Pat Walker is editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Alicia Blaisdell-Bannon is managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Massachusetts.
Still to come, never let them see you sweat, the mantra of cool actors and cool filmmakers. Our critics pick their favorites.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Quick, name the country where oil was discovered in the 30s. It has an area of about 665 square kilometers. It's become wealthy from business and banking. Well, if you don't know the answer, we know three American teenagers who do, and it helped them beat teams from 18 other countries to win the gold medal at the National Geographic World Championship. 13-year-old Dallas Simons from Tennessee was on the winning team. He's just come home. He's on the line from Nashville. Welcome, Dallas, and congratulations.
Thank you.
And tell us right away, because curious people want to know.
Bahrain.
And as if that weren't enough that you knew that answer, you went on to name Crete as the island where oranges, grapes, and olives are grown and is associated with the worship of Zeus. How did you know that?
They said it was home to the ancient Minoan civilization for the fourth clue. And once they said that, we all knew that it was Crete.
Well, of course. Sure. Dallas, this is quite an accomplishment. Did you know that you had a chance at taking the whole thing?
Well, once I placed second in the National B, I think I had a pretty good shot, but I wasn't sure yet.
Yeah. How do you get ready for something like this? How do you know what you know?
Mostly it's knowing where things are, like in a map. I use many different library books, different atlases. The World Almanac is good for current events. Most of all, I read the National Geographic desk reference.
You say library books. Do you go on the computer at all?
I go on the computer some. Not as much as I read books.
Your other team members were John Rice of Mattock, North Dakota, and Alexander Smith of Burlington, North Carolina. They're both 15. You're 13. And one of them was homeschooled. You went to public school. So did you do a lot of this on your own?
Yes, I did most of it on my own. I think I've always had a real big interest in geography. I think that's one of the main reasons that I study hard and I want to do well in these things.
Mm. I understand that in addition to having to name countries on maps, there was a part of the World Championship B where they brought animals on stage and you had to identify them?
Well, they brought an animal on the stage and they'd ask about a park or a place where it was located, and we'd have to read the clues and try and figure out where it was from.
What was the hardest one?
Well, ours was a boa constrictor brought out from an island that separates the Amazon and the Paraná rivers, and it was Marajo Island.
Oh, boy. Well, I know that the questions were written by members of the National Geographic Society and other teachers. Why don't we, let's see if we can give our listeners a little quiz. Give us one of the questions from the competition. Let's see how we do.
Okay. Congo's Adzala National Park is home to the largest concentration of western lowland gorillas in the world. This park is located east of which country? Is it A, Gabon, B, Burundi, C, Central African Republic, or D, Democratic Republic of the Congo?
Everybody knows that. It's what?
A, Gabon.
Oh, boy. Okay. Dallas, you know what we decided? We have a couple questions for you as well.
Okay.
Okay. You ready for this?
Sure.
What's the capital of Georgia?
Which one?
See, you're so smart. Not the Atlanta one, the Tbilisi one. Okay. Let's see. What's the capital of Armenia?
Yerevan.
Correct again. All right. It sounds like you're going to do terrific things with your knowledge. What do you want to do when you grow up?
Either something having to do with geography or an engineer or an architect.
Well, that all makes sense. And with a name like Dallas, it seems that from birth you were meant to do it.
Yes.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you.
Dallas Simons was on the American team that won the National Geographic World Championship this past week.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In the heat of summer, how about a cool movie to lower the temperature? Cool as in Robert Mitchum cool, or Pam Grier, I don't give a damn cool, or for that matter, Cool Hand Luke cool. Director Billy Wilder is cool, so is Quentin Tarantino. Tarantino's slick 1994 film Pulp Fiction took cool, edgy cinema to below freezing. When was the birth of the cool in movies? Maybe it was Cagney or Hepburn or James Dean and Nicholas Ray's 1955 classic Rebel Without a Cause as he tries to thwart a fight with a knife-wielding teenage punk.
You know something?
No, what?
You read too many comic books.
Well, he's real abstract. He's different.
That's right. That's right. I'm cute, too.
Move.
And too cool for school? How about the leather-clad crew in The Matrix?
Have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you were so sure was real? What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
This can't be.
Be what? Be real?
So cool. But how do they move around in those long leather jackets? Well, here in the studio, with their candidates for cool videos for hot summer nights, Here Now's film reviewers Renee Graham and Eric Schaefer. Eric, those coats were so cool looking, were they not?
They are. Fashion is the thing in The Matrix.
But attitude is also what makes cool in the movies, right?
Attitude really is everything, and that attitude always has to be embodied in some way in the actors. You can't manufacture cool. Cool has to come about naturally.
Right, you have it or you don't. Renee, we were saying earlier, you and I were going through the list. Katharine Hepburn was cool. Audrey Hepburn wasn't cool. She was wonderful, but she wasn't cool.
Lovely, wonderful, definitely not cool.
Well, what is your idea of cool, Renee?
Cool film has a swagger. It has a singular rhythm. It has its own language and its own way of moving through the world. For instance, I think the original Godfather is a cool film. Godfather 2 is a better film, but it's not a cool film. You know, the line from the original, leave the gun, take the cannoli, that's cool. Fredo, I Know It Was You from the second one, not cool.
And poor Godfather 3, which I have to say, my brother was in that movie, but it was not cool at all. Cool actors, Eric?
Oh, there are just so many. Humphrey Bogart is cool. Cary Grant is cool. Marlon Brando, sometimes. Toshiro Mifune, who we'll be talking about.
Got to give props to the ladies. Pam Grier,
mm-hmm.
Always, always cool.
Always cool.
Lauren Bacall.
Very cool.
Well, let's start with your candidates for cool. Eric, you go first.
Well, we've got things divided up into contemporary cool and classic cool. And sort of working our way from the present back, my first pick is a movie from 1994 called The Last Seduction. A movie starring Linda Fiorentino as Bridget, who is the ultimate femme fatale. Mm-hmm. She rips off her husband. She's convinced him to do a drug deal, and then she rips him off and goes and sets up shop in upstate New York. And in this scene, she's talking to her lawyer to find out how she can basically get away with keeping the money while losing her husband.
Friend needs advice. I'll set it up for you. Husband and wife do a one-time drug deal. The goal's a wholesome one.
College fund for the kids.
No. The wife wants new digs. Comes off without a hitch.
Only the wife decides that the new house would be happier without the husband.
Sharing was never her specialty.
She's anxious to start spending.
Well, it's just an opinion since you're not paying for it. But the husband is entitled to half of whatever you buy with that cash. In fact, as soon as you turn it into a legal asset like a condo or a house or a bank account, he can make a claim on it.
What are you saying?
My lips moving too fast for you?
Not fast enough, as I recall.
Nothing like the sassy comeback.
and this movie is filled with sassy comebacks. What's so wonderful about this movie is Fiorentino. She is so remorseless that we're really rooting for her, sort of against our own sort of sense of moral outrage. We are rooting for her all the way along.
Okay, Eric Schaefer's pick for contemporary cool, The Last Seduction with Linda Fiorentino from 94. Okay, Renee, your contemporary cool pick.
First one we want to talk about is Sexy Beast from 2000. It starred Ray Winston as a retired British gangster who now lives at a beautiful villa in Spain with his wife and his two friends. And he has this absolutely idyllic life. The way that this co-star, Ben Kingsley, who plays Don Logan, has described the film is, once there was the happiest man in the world, and into his life, the godsend, the unhappiest man in the world. The unhappiest man in the world is Don Logan, played by Ben Kingsley, who comes from England to recruit Winston's character, whose name is Gal, into One Last Heist. And we've seen the One Last Heist movie a zillion times. It's the way that the movie sort of spins everything on its head. Because at its core, this is really a love story. It's about the love between Gal and his wife, Dee Dee, and just the love of the life he now has and how much he doesn't want to go back to the way things were. The beginning of the movie, the early part of the movie, is the Don Logan character, who Kingsley really plays as a sociopathic child, trying to recruit Gal back into the life.
Do it.
I'm really tired.
Do it.
This is madness. I've had enough of this crime and punishment bollocks. Am I happy here?
I won't let you be happy. Why should I? Friday, the Grosvenor, you'll be there.
I won't.
You will. I told Ted you're doing it. Don't you show me up.
No, I won't be there.
You will. You missed the Roundtree.
No.
Yes, Roundtree.
No.
Yes, Grosvenor.
No, Don.
Friday.
I won't be there.
You will.
No, Don.
Yes, yes, yes.
I'm only laughing because that's a Sexy Beast, the British crime drama from the year 2000, Renee Graham's pick for contemporary cool. But I'm laughing because I'm thinking the antithesis of cool would be A Fish Called Wanda, which sort of sounds just like that, but nobody was cool.
Nobody was cool. Everything in this movie is cool. You know, it starts off, you know, the movie opens up with this song called Peaches by this proto-punk band. It's this nasty little song called Peaches, and it ends with this song called Sway from the early 1950s by Dean Martin. Music is a character in this film. film. It propels the story along. There are scenes where there's just music but no dialogue, and it works as well as if there were dialogue. It's a wonderful film.
Dee Martin was cool, Jerry Lewis was not, and I liked him anyway. Let's look at cool classics. Eric, your pick for a classic cool film.
My pick is probably one of the ultimate noir films of all time, 1947's Out of the Past, with Mr. Cool himself, Robert Mitchum. And in this movie, Mitchum plays a private eye who's hired by a gambler to find the girl who shot him and took off with $40,000. Mitchum goes to Mexico, he finds her, but then he falls in love with her. Years later, Douglas comes back and pulls Mitchum back into the fold to sort of get revenge on him. And in this scene, we find Mitchum meeting with a secretary in San Francisco and trying to figure out just how he's being set up to take a fall.
It's a nice apartment you have here.
Yes, these old houses can be amusing when they're remodeled, can't they?
I used to live in one in New York that was old. Wasn't very amusing.
I've never been to New York.
You take a trip there sometime. You'll see one reason why I'm in San Francisco. Which said you'd tell me the other?
You know, you're rather charming yourself, but I'm afraid I don't quite understand you.
Well, if you'll drop this junior league patter, we may get the conversation down where it belongs.
It's a brilliant movie. The black and white photography is just incredible. And Mitchum is so effortlessly cool that it's criminal.
Black and white is cool. Color is not. Okay, Out of the Past, starring Robert Mitchum. And Renee, your cool classic.
A cool black and white film, Yojimbo, which is an Akira Kurosawa film from 1961. And it stars Toshiro Mifune as a masterless samurai in 19th century Japan. It's a Western. It was Kurosawa's ode to the great American Westerns that he'd watched for years. And what Toshiro Mifune's character Sanjiro does is he sort of inserts himself between these two warring merchants, partially for money and partially just for his own amusement, and tries to turn them against each other. And he has to prove to the merchants that he's worth hiring. So he goes about dispatching of one of the merchants' henchmen.
Okay, so that sounded painful.
It is painful. The film is in Japanese, and that's a nasty little scene because he whacks one guy's arm off, and you see the arm sort of fly off with the samurai sword still in it.
And the cool part?
The cool part is Mifune. You know, he does this. He plays the character with this sort of carefree attitude. He's hunching his shoulders. He's got his toothpick. And he really doesn't care about anything or anyone's code but his own. It was the basis for the Clint Eastwood film A Fistful of Dollars in the 1996 Bruce Willis film, Last Man Standing.
But Yojimbo was based on The Glass Key by Dashiell Hammett.
There you go.
Well, and you also gave us one last thought. Clint Eastwood, way cool. Well, thank you both for your cool movie picks.
Thank you, Robin.
You're welcome.
Here in Now's film reviewers Renee Graham and Eric Schaefer. For a list of their cool movie picks and others, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
Have a great weekend and join us again here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. I'm Bill Delaney. I'm